You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University. For those of you who've been regular listeners of the show, if you caught our episode on the Sabbath, you'll know that Ed Song has suspended his podcasting activities for the present. Whether that will be permanent or not, we don't know. Ed is taking time to think and pray about such things. This is going to be our first sort of regular episode without Ed, though we have some other pre-recorded episodes that will continue to drop, so things are just going to be a little bit out of joint for a while on the show, and I'm sorry about that. I'm just too lazy to go back and do things like edit endings and fix the outros and so on. Just so the listeners know what the plan is going to be going forward, right now the City of Man is going to have three kinds of episodes. The first is going to be the sort that listeners should be used to already, an occasional series doing a deep dive into a specific topic. So we've done one of these series on ancient Roman government, one on C.S. Lewis's space trilogy. We're working our way through another on country music. We have yet a fourth in the works on a different topic that will be revealed at some future date. So that's one thing that will continue, these deep dives into specific topics. Second, we will do occasional episodes on issues or topics that are controversial or timely. For these episodes, we have a number of guest hosts who have volunteered to appear on the show from different political perspectives within the evangelical world, different perspectives, that is, than mine. Whether this is progressive or libertarian or anarchist or what have you is just going to depend on the topic and whoever volunteers to come on the show. And then finally, we'll be doing episodes based on texts or readings, which is what we're doing today. The guests on these episodes may or may not be from the politically other side of the spectrum than me, since these episodes are ideally going to be governed by the text rather than requiring an active advocate from a competing worldview. And again, you get a sample of such an episode today, where we're joined by Josh Herring. Josh is Dean of Students at Thales Academy in North Carolina, where he lives with his wife. Josh, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Coyle. I'm thrilled to be here. I have to tell you, thank you so much for pronouncing our school's name correctly. You don't know how many times we get Thales Academy, so I'm just so happy that you got us as Thales. That was rather marvelous.
Thales Academy. I'm trying to imagine calling the philosopher Thales.
Thales. So one knows about Thales, so they look at it and think, that must be the word sales with a lisp, and they're always wrong. So,
and clearly people need more Greek.
That's one of the things our author today is certainly, he's a big fan. He'd love to see more Greek and Latin coming out.
Yeah, I was going to say that would be a great segue, but first, can you give us like a 30 to 60 second introduction to yourself?
Sure. So I've been listening to the Christian Humanist Network really for probably about 6 or 7 years now. It sort of was I found great comfort in it because I came from Hillsdale College. I graduated from Hillsdale in 2011 and then went down south to North Carolina to go to Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. And while I was there, seminary is kind of an odd place. It's not a terribly liberal artsy place, at least Southeastern isn't. And listening to the Christian Humanist became really a way to keep in touch with a lot of things I love doing at Hillsdale. So I've been listening to the network for a long time. And then I'm currently working on a PhD with Faulkner University. It'll be a degree in humanities with concentration in literature. And hoping that should all be done by May of 2023. Who knows? We'll see what the timeline actually looks like. My wife and I live in Wendell, North Carolina. We both teach at Thales Academy. Thales is a secular classical school network that's based around the city of Raleigh in North Carolina. I'm pretty excited about that. We're starting our new school year in a couple weeks. We're a year-round school, and we get all the excitement of figuring out how do we meet in person in the building in the era of COVID-19. So that's pretty. It's going to be very interesting. We have lots of innovation and new ideas coming out. At the school, my job encompasses really three main things. I teach a philosophy course to our 11th graders. I'm serving as dean of students this year, and I also run our debate program. So, Coyle, I was really excited that you were open to the idea of me coming on the show. I'm quite excited to get to talk about today's essay with you. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And can you tell us what you're thinking again, just quickly? What are you thinking for a dissertation topic?
So I settled on this. I at least started thinking about this a year ago, and it keeps getting a little more refined, which I've heard is how it's supposed to go.
Right.
I did a seminar up in Mecosta, Michigan, on the life and writings of Russell Kirk last summer, and as part of that, I was browsing through Kirk's library that they have restored there, and I got intrigued by a collection of Arthurian literature, and then. As also part of that class, I read an essay he wrote about T.S. Eliot's poem The Wasteland, all about everybody tells me that The Wasteland is about Arthur and the Arthurian wasteland, which is what Kirk is arguing in that essay. I just read The Wasteland a couple weeks ago, and I cannot understand it. So I'm over there with all the other people who don't understand the poem. Anyway, I read that and thought, okay, Eliot's writing about Arthur. I love what Lewis does in That Hideous Strength, and I also really enjoyed listening to y'all's episodes on that. That was really fun. And then Charles Williams also has at least one novel called War in Heaven that is his version of an Arthurian tale. And all three of those authors seem to be very interested in using the Arthurian legends as a way of processing or understanding the changes in 20th century modernism. So I want to kind of explore that, though I think I'm probably going to switch. I think I want to drop T.S. Eliot and replace him with Tolkien, because Tolkien's poem, The Fall of Arthur, is published posthumously. But it, too, is doing the same kind of thing, where Tolkien is, I think, relatively clearly thinking through a post-Christian Europe and what does it look like to have a Europe that is transitioning. And he uses Arthur as this transitional figure where you're going from post-Roman to European civilization. But Tolkien kind of has in mind, what does this look like instead of going from pagan to Christian, now moving from Christian to something different in the aftermath of after World War I. I don't remember exactly when he finished drafting the poem. He never finished it. So anyway, to make that hopefully not too long of an answer, I want to look at the way that different authors in the early 20th century who are all kind of bound together. Lewis, Williams, and Tolkien all fit together as inklings, so there's at least some connection to justify those three. And I want to look at how all three of those are using the Arthurian legendarium to process the changes in the world around them.
Well, we should get into the topic. We're talking today about an essay called Academic Leadership by Paul Elmer Moore. Paul Elmer Moore is one of the early 20th century conservative intellectuals, kind of teaming up with Irving Babbitt. The two were good friends, taught together, I think, at Harvard. And I want to say both of them were T.S. Eliot's professors when he was in college. I didn't do a whole lot of biographical prep for this, but that much, I think, is all fairly true. Moore would say that by studying Arthur and the kind of early medieval canon, you're not far from the kingdom, right? You're close to where you should be.
And well, that's good to hear.
He starts this essay by outlining the problem that we face, not just in academia, not just in higher education, but kind of in society in general. And he doesn't use the word, but he says that we have a sense of existential unease, especially amongst thoughtful people. And then he outlines these five things that people are unsettled over. First, what he calls the unsettlement of property, that is the uncertainty that my property will continue to be my property or your property will continue to be your property. Concern over provision for the future by the middle class, a concern over the collapse of decorum and decency. A concern over society's pursuit of excitement, we might say entertainment, at any cost. and then concern over the decay of religion and the undermining of society that results from that. All of which could be written today, in a sense, because and he points this out, people have kind of always wrung their hands over these sorts of things. We all know that civilization is fragile, and that even with our great technological innovations, we shouldn't be overconfident. Even modern ships can wreck and sink. In the 21st century, we might say even modern ships undergo outbreaks of E. coli or coronavirus. I looked this up for this episode. It is not currently possible to book a cruise, and again, that's there are a handful of foreign companies that will sell you tickets for 2021. But even there, they come with all kinds of disclaimers and warnings and third-party websites saying don't do it. So again, that's we're in some senses not unique. But what Moore says, this is really a different kind of anxiety. The regular concern of thoughtful people in the past kind of regular civilized concerns was that barbarism is going to be pounding down the gates. The orders of society are not going to be able to stand up to the external shocks hammering down our institutions. Today, Moore says our concern is different. Our concern is that the people who should be the champions of order themselves don't even know their duty and might very well be contributing to the decay of society. So the people who should be there sort of holding the line are the people who are actually beginning to break things down, either out of ignorance or out of kind of willful destruction. So we need some kind of recovered and reformed leadership. Without that, our society is going to be led around by its ambitions and passions instead of putting those ambitions and passions to work in the name of higher principles and faculties. And there should be kind of a Platonic note there for listeners who've followed the core curriculum through Plato's Republic. That's one of his main concerns. We feel this dissatisfaction in education as well. We almost don't even have to say it. It's so commonly understood. College doesn't do its job. Students and faculty alike know this. This is a quote from the essay. Boys come into college with no reading and with minds unused to the very practice of study, and they leave college too often in the same state of nature. All of this then raises the question, well, what is education for? Josh, anything to add to that? That's kind of my summary of the first page or two of Moore's essay.
Yeah, I think that was a very effective summary. The only thing I'll add is just a couple of contemporary notes. As you were kind of going through that, his first 4 points about unsettlement of property and the uncertainty of the future and so on, that just seems so relevant to the past really 6 weeks. I don't know what riots have looked like in Missouri, but in North Carolina, they have been kind of pretty prevalent in Raleigh and in Charlotte and in a lot of unexpectedly smaller towns. And just the I know one friend who just opened a barbecue restaurant near us, and he had a late night panic when he received a tip that it was possible that the rioters might move just a couple of blocks. And this store that has been 3 years in the making might now have to deal with unexpected losses just in the first really month of their being actually open to the public. And so the lack of uncertainty there and the lack of security of property, I think, is like it's just spot on that we're Moore saw something there. And I'm sure historically he's right that this is not new. And yet it just seems to me to be increasingly relevant. But that it's paralleled with the you've got a note here about our those who are champions of order themselves don't even know their duty. And there are people who I expected to be really the champions of order in society who really have not been willing to uphold order. It's as if the protesters or the rioters seem to have the moral high ground. And so mayors, police, and governors are not willing to uphold law and order. They're not willing to hold the line to say, if you protest, it must be in an orderly and decent way that is recognized and done in collaboration with the state. Instead, it's as if in Raleigh, our government has not been very helpful in suppressing violence. Instead, they've taken a hands-off approach to almost expect the protesters and the rioters to govern themselves. The police have been present, but they've been under various instructions to not engage and not create further problems, which I understand the desire to not further violence. I also would really like a government that was firmly committed to rule of law and enforcing rule of law. So that just seems like somehow I think Moore is asking very perennial questions that seem to have come back around in relevance in the last few weeks.
Yeah, and we have a big country and things are different basically in every place. So there's certainly the unsettlement of property in the sense of businesses that have been destroyed. Although by the time we're recording this, that seems to have quieted down a little bit. But there's also the unsettlement of property in the sense of people are losing their jobs. Right, unemployment rates are up. The economy is down. Will I be able to hold on to my property, or am I going to have to sell it to feed my family? Right, those sorts of concerns are certainly there as well. So even in terms of the riots, which again, that at this point that seems to have tapered off. I'd hate to make universal statements just because things are so different in Raleigh than they are in St. Louis, than they are in Minneapolis, than they are in Bolivar, Missouri. We haven't had any riots. We have had a couple of protests, but they were by and large tame and quiet and kind of the ideal, the platonic ideal of protests, I think, really. The fact of the matter is, even if officials, politicians, community leaders, whatever category of people you want to include in your governing class, and Moore would not confine that to politicians, as we'll see shortly, the fact of the matter is, people don't know how to respond, even if they want to. Right? What is law and order is a question that many of our leaders can't answer, and that in some ways is a result of the collapse of education, which then raises this question of what is education for? And Josh, can you take us through that? What does Moore outline as the points, principles of education?
Sure.
Meaning college, right? We're not talking about high school or middle school or what have you.
Yeah, I think that's important to keep in mind for what he's doing. He's not talking about K-12. He is definitively looking at this kind of really unique thing of leaving home, going somewhere that's a specific institution of higher study, get your degree, and then really, he's also not talking about graduate study and advanced degrees. He's really looking at that undergraduate 4 years that for centuries has seemed to have something to do with the leadership of society and those who have kind of either a family tradition of being involved in political leadership or personal ambitions to somehow be able to tell others what is right and good for society to do. We somehow seem to see that connected with college, and that's the sort of education that he is focusing on. So throughout his essay, Moore describes education accomplish several goals. I'm kind of just follow the read a quote and comment on it sort of method here. Coyle, do feel free to jump in if there's anything interesting you want to chime in on any of these quotes. He writes, until they can rediscover some common ground of strength and purpose in the first principles of education and law and property and religion, we are in danger of falling prey to the disorganizing and vulgarizing domination of ambitions, which should be the servants and not the masters of society. He's getting at there's something about college that should help people understand the structure of society as a whole. And they should see how the whole of society works together, such that we can arrange society in a way that there are certain things that serve our common interest, and there are certain things that rule over those other things that serve our common interest. Now, I don't think he's not bringing up an Aristotelian kind of natural slave idea here. He's looking literally at kind of society needs these pieces and it has other pieces as well. And it all has to work together in a sort of congenial hierarchy if we want to have society work as a whole. And there's something about college that should help us discover these common ground strengths and purposes when we understand the first principles of education, law, property, and religion. If we don't have those first principles, then we're losing civilization and moving more towards barbarism. So he kind of has this polarity. There's the barbarism that looms, and there's civilization that we have gained. And college education has something to do with preserving those fruits of civilization. He goes on and says, it will be pretty generally agreed that efficiency of the individual scholar and the unity of the scholarly class are properly only the means to obtain the real end of education, which is social efficiency. I thought this was really interesting that he does tell us what he thinks the purpose of education is, and it's social efficiency. Coyle, any particular thoughts on what he means by that phrase, social efficiency?
So by efficiency, he's very clear. Efficiency isn't what he calls the management style of efficiency, right? It's a slippery word to use because it can mean so many different things. And what most of us mean is, you know, I got my oil changed and it was really quick. I'm a shift supervisor at the local fast food joint, and I can really get people to do their jobs well. That's not what he means by efficiency. That really doesn't need to be taught at college, doesn't require any discipline and can't predict any consequences, right? It doesn't have that sort of forward-thinking component that we want our leadership class to have. Instead, we want efficiency that is a synthesizer, right? It takes the best from every area of society, from religion, from law, from politics, and in a disciplined way brings them together in a sort of imaginative vision that then inspires the rest of society to move in a virtuous direction towards, he's going to talk about freedom later, right? But towards a specific kind of freedom. So it's efficiency, but it's a targeted efficiency, and it's certainly not the way that we would commonly use the word. And then he has thoughts about what discipline best teaches that. Did you want to say anything else about the purpose of education? The purpose of education then is to create individuals can do that, who can do that, right?
Yeah, I've got one more quote that really does kind of like drive that whole idea home. He says, the scheme of the humanist might be described in a word as a disciplining of the higher faculty of the imagination, to the end that the student may behold, as it were in one sublime vision, the whole scale of being in its range, from the lowest to the highest, under the divine decree of order and subordination, without losing sight of the immutable veracity at the heart of all development, which is only the praise and surname of virtue. So that whole idea is, it seems to me as if the student is the one who does not yet perceive the whole and how the whole is bound together. And yet through his study, he understands how all the different parts of society are bound together and are moving, not necessarily in a contemporary progressive politics kind of direction, but the idea of that there is some sort of progress. It's a progress towards almost a Platonic vision of the good. And in the same way that Plato has trouble pinning down what exactly the good is, I think it's hard to articulate what exactly how college does that. But I think those who've experienced it can agree there's something about deep study on a bunch of different areas that all leads to rightly understanding here's how all the pieces of society fit together. And no one piece is either tyrannical or unnecessary. We, in fact, need all those parts together to form a body politic that can grow towards the best version of itself. So something like that, I think, is what he's articulating that. I think that's really what he sees education is all about, and where he's going to see college as preparing the future aristocrats of society in a very positive sense of aristocracy. Those who have that kind of vision are the ones who are best capable of leading society towards the good. That's what I've got on the purpose. Anything I've missed?
No. I think that's right. This is a point that probably needs to be made. We are going to have leadership, right? Society will have leaders, and it's sort of a question of whether we will have aristocrats in the good sense of the term, or we'll have demagogues. And that difference, Moore is saying, in part is a function of the kind of education they're given. I suppose we could have the argument about whether that's an accurate statement. Being a conservative, I don't see how that couldn't possibly be accurate, but that's certainly been argued with in the past. The point of education is to create these aristocrats who can then lead those of us who are not aristocrats, which by definition is going to be almost everyone else, in a good direction. And Moore thinks that the discipline at the heart of this has to be the classics, right? Specifically, Greek and Latin, both the languages and the literature. Josh, why Why can't science be the core of this? Why can't physics or chemistry or biology or even fake sciences like psychology or political science or sociology? We like to think of ourselves as real scientists, but, you know, come on. They don't let us experiment. I can't build a wall around a city and come back 10 years later and see what happened.
I'm just going to point out that you can say that authentically as a political scientist. I get in trouble when I say that I don't think psychology is a real science. So I'm just glad you said it and not me. I think the key for Moore is the idea of discipline. And for him, I think there's an immense attraction to the classical languages of Greek and Latin. And then, if I understand him correctly, primarily reading literature in Greek and Latin, but also then later training of other people who write but are steeped in Greek and Latin, because he has really good things to say about reading Shakespeare. But that doesn't quite seem to fit with his emphasis on classics. But I think for him, the idea of discipline is key, because he is thinking about undisciplined minds, that quote you read at the beginning about the boys who come to college and they don't know how to study. They're very undisciplined in how they think. And what they really need in order to be able to have these imaginations that perceive the whole is a discipline that trains them to see things rightly. And for Moore, that discipline is best found. He doesn't think it's only found here, but it's best found in the classical languages of Greek and Latin. And again, he doesn't say this. I'm kind of inferring this. But I presume that's because for Latin in particular, Latin is such a highly, highly constructed, disciplined language. Because it's been the language of scholarship for over 1,000 years when Moore is writing this, it's been – my wife's a Latin teacher, so she's told me most of this. I don't have any Latin. I have a little bit of Greek. But I did find this was also true for learning New Testament Greek in particular. But for Latin, it's been so carefully constructed by scholars so that they can carefully teach the same method that there's really not a huge call for creativity. And when you go to study a language, particularly an old one like Latin or Greek, you have a very particular goal. You want to be able to read Quintilian in the original. You want to be able to read Homer or Plato or the New Testament in the original. And what that does is it's a very particular crafting and shaping of the mind such that – and the way then the mechanism for helping people gather these skills is the task of translation, where you are looking for the precise translation of this word into a whole different mode of thought. And when you can do that well, you master that craft, it produces a discipline of mind that is what's going to lend itself to perceiving the whole. So for Moore, I think discipline is really the key, and he has some – I was kind of protesting. He does not think that literary studies are very disciplined. he thinks that sometimes a good teacher can be disciplined, but usually he says it's you memorize a bunch of dates where they ascend to the o altitudo of just talking about meaninglessly beautiful passages that no one really understands. And there's some truth to that, but I don't think that's not why we read great books. But there's some truth to that. But I think the he would put the sciences as also lacking that discipline in the way they're taught in undergraduate education. He talks about simplistic experiments in chemistry that don't really lend themselves to the precise discipline that he's trying to say should be the heart of college education.
Right.
Does that fit?
Yeah. So there's obviously when you're doing a chemistry experiment, I shouldn't use chemistry because I've never had a chemistry class. When you're doing a physics experiment, right, you are in a sense being disciplined. You have to be very careful with the equipment. It's expensive. You don't want to break it. You have to be very careful while you're doing it. You don't want to, you know, shoot the marble too hard and kill someone. I mean, there are all sorts of disciplines that go along with it. But at the end of the day, what you're experimenting on is such a narrow, small thing. Right. Even if you're using, you know, a particle accelerator, you're still only controlling for one variable in a properly run experiment. And I'm saying this as someone who learned the rules of science almost 30 years ago at this point. So maybe they've changed, and maybe that's no longer the case. And maybe now scientists do try to have a bigger picture view of things. Functionally, the discipline you learn is very specific. It's I don't remember if this is the passage where he calls it the disciplines of the trades. Which certainly are important and certainly have their own case, but it's their own place. But it's the discipline I have when I'm, you know, sawing a board or trying to get an angle just right when I'm building a frame or a shelf or whatever. It's not that it's not important, but I'm not thinking about what is the highest possible good of this shelf and how can it best serve, you know, my family and society and so on. I'm thinking, how can I get this angle just right? And really what you need is both, right? You need that narrow view and that wide angle view. And Moore thinks that it's the classics, specifically the languages of Latin and Greek, and then the substance of what you're reading. He gets into that a little bit too. In part because just what's survived tends to be the better stuff, and because of the topics that what's survived deals with, and because we are so shaped by the ancient world that all of those things sort of come together in Greek and Latin in a way that Old English doesn't, right? In a way that the Arthur romance, as important as it might be, it doesn't have that same combination of specific and broad that sort of opens up the vision of the good.
I think that's right. There's a lot there that is in the classics. I know there was a meme circulating not too long ago about in contemporary Spanish. If you're studying Spanish 101, you might learn where is the bathroom. But if you are studying Intro to Latin, it would not be odd to run across a phrase that maybe says, you have violated the love of the patria, and therefore, because you have betrayed the good of the state, you must die at the hand of the whole community. And there's a much greater complexity that's packed into the classics, right, than into some other things.
That would be four words in Latin.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I assume Greek is similar. I've had just a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of Greek, but I assume it's similar too.
It can be. I mean, most of my Greek was in Koine for reading New Testament stuff, and it tends to be very common. The New Testament is not it's not the place I would go to teach someone beautiful prose. Mostly.
Right.
Revelation is different. Revelation is wonderful, but 1 Timothy is not amazing, beautiful prose. It's clear. That's the goal for Koine. But if you're looking at anything like Attic Greek, you have much more complexity and the ability to pack in a ton of nuance in single letters. Right. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do with that.
Well, anything else you want to say on the classics?
Probably the only thing that we haven't touched on yet is that really the classics. For as much as Moore he's in favor of a sort of an aristocracy in terms of the community, it's an open aristocracy that there's right. A bit of meritocracy involved here, that we don't get this aristocracy through birth. You can acquire this through study. So there's a sense in which he talks about how through the classics, you can sort of be adopted into what the 18th century often called a republic of letters, and that we can sort of we ascend to this level of ideas that other people all around the world through their their studies have also ascended to, and we converse on that level, and that we get there not through blood but rather through effort, which I think is really interesting, because I think there's people tend to, in my circles at least, people hear the word aristocracy and they assume snobbery. But I don't think that's what Moore is getting at all. He's instead opening up a level to say, here is this good that is worth aspiring to, and you can get it if you do the work and discipline your mind. You too can be one of these intellectual aristocrats.
Yeah, and the classics is the if we dare use the phrase, a sort of common core on which that aristocracy ought to be built, right?
The good common core, not the bad educational common core, a good common core.
Yeah, we need to do a common core episode at some point. I do not hate it as much as everyone else did, you know, 7 years ago. That hatred is sort of past, and people, I think, have just kind of accepted it these days. But
I love the idea. The idea of the Common Core was a beautiful idea. I mean, it was a liberal arts style
yep.
dream. Execution was terrible. If you compare Common Core with local subsidiarity, you've got a chance of a really cool thing happening. But Common Core executed on a federal level was a train wreck.
Well, and that local subsidiarity requires basically local aristocrats who are willing to kind of take the reins and do that. And we have Well, that's a rant for another day. Our gutting of local institutions over the last 150 years is a rant for another time. Although perhaps timely during the COVID business, if we had, you know, vigorous and robust local governments, how much better would everyone's anyway. Could go on about that for a while. So Greek and Latin, the classics, is the foundation, and then all of the other disciplines. Moore says you can then specialize from there, and he doesn't lay out a program. I don't know if. You know, is this the first 2 years of college? Is this your, you get your undergraduate degree in this, and then you go to grad school? I'm not sure exactly what he means. How much of this, like, are you supposed to be proficient in Greek and Latin, or is a year of it enough? I mean, what exactly is he going for? He doesn't say.
I almost kind of imagine him, like, and this is the only Moore I've read, so it's probably not fair for me to imagine too much off of this one essay. But I sort of imagine him as kind of foreshadowing Russell Kirk saying that if you want a program, you've missed what I've really had to say. Wanting specifics is somehow, but for those who are actually involved, like you and I are involved in the actual task of functional education.
Right.
I mean, this I want to know, how do we put this into practice? And that doesn't really seem to be what he's interested in. In this essay, at least.
Right. And I mean, I suppose you could go and get a syllabus from a class he taught I guess they had a syllabus back then. I don't know for sure. I knew all of that at one point, and I need to bone up on it for. I pitched this as an essay. I'm teaching a class this coming spring on the politics of higher education, and I think this is going to be part of it. I need to figure out what they were doing in the early 20th century. So we could find out some of his practical application, but that's not what he's doing in this essay, which is frustrating because like, all right, fine, I need to be doing the classics. Well, what does that mean in practice? What should a student be able to do by the time they're done with their freshman year of college? What should a student be able to do by the time they graduate? At what point do you specialize? What point do you know? And maybe that's just a 21st century desire to measure everything, and that's how we get, you know, SATs and GREs and all of that. But it's still a fair question. How do you measure the success of a college education?
I think it's a very fair question, because I mean, as much as I love the liberal arts dream of, do you perceive the order and nature of things? Because I think that's what he's really getting at.
Sure.
I can't really ask. I'm trying to think of, like, this past year I was involved in several more interviewing teacher candidates for my school. And that's not really a question I can ask in a job interview. Not that everything needs to be measured.
So you could ask it. See what happens.
I could. But I need something for the sake of a school and for the sake of institutions and for the sake of moving beyond the 10 students who attach themselves to a really amazing professor. For getting beyond that, we need something concrete to point to. And yeah. I'm not sure that Moore gives us a whole lot of concreteness to point to.
Anything else on the classics? Otherwise, we'll move on to the aristocracy.
It may just be worth noting that he's writing this early enough that if anybody were to try and put this in place today, they would need to think very carefully about what text constitute the classics, because I don't know exactly what he means by the classics. I know in my PhD program, there's a constant back and forth among students who intentionally chose a great books-based doctoral program. What constitutes the great books? Institutionally, right. The program is built around Mortimer Adler's list,
right?
But it takes about 10 seconds to realize, okay, Mortimer Adler was a person, and he just kind of picked the books he really, really thought mattered.
Right.
Well, why are those the great books? So there would be an additional level of selectivity involved in actually implementing, okay, we're going to make everybody read these 12 treatises in Latin and these 6 treatises in Greek. Well, why those and not others? Like, I don't know that Moore gives us that in this essay, but I would want to know that before we tried to put it into practice.
Right, and I suppose he might get around that by emphasizing the language. You know, if you can read the language, then you can kind of read whatever of these you want to. But he's also clearly, he's not talking about reading, you know, Isaac Newton in Latin. He's you know, maybe you should also do that. I think Newton is on Adler's List, but he's talking. You read the ancient Greeks and Romans, and not so much the modern stuff, unless that's your specialization. But yeah, you're right. Which classics? Which even in the Greeks and Romans, not all of them make it onto Adler's List.
Well, I mean, do you read the? I mean, there's some really funny, really dirty Latin poetry. Do you read that, or do you read Virgil? I mean, they're both contemporaries.
Right. Well, even Virgil or Ovid, right? I mean, that's you don't have to go to the
Ovid. Whew.
Yeah. Well, we should jump into then the goal of all of this, the nature of aristocracy, and Moore points out, look, the old hereditary aristocracies, they've rightly largely passed away. It's the job of education, and again, especially higher education, to replace these hereditary aristocracies with an aristocracy of what Moore calls character and intelligence. This nobility of the intellect means, first of all, purging ourselves of envy, and then, second, a fellowship in preservation rather than in destruction. These two characteristics, plus trained efficiency, are and then confirmed by faithful comradeship, that's where he says we get the sort of rightful governors of the people. And again, he doesn't mean that in just a political sense. He means that in sort of a wide-ranging sense. So who are the celebrities, right? Who are the writers and the actors and the artists and the culture makers, in addition to who are our politicians? Well, the good aristocrats are going to be the people who have those characteristics. That purging of envy, it's something that maybe conservatives still talk about. I tend to see it more in memes than I do in intellectual conservative writings these days. But the idea, I think, is that often what's driving a more radical spirit is the desire to take what someone else has, right? Whether for conservatives in Moore's time, that's going to mean French revolutionaries inspired by Rousseau and Marxists. Those are going to be his specific targets. And then on the positive side, the desire to, instead of taking what someone else has, preserve what we have and pass it on to future generations. Like you said earlier, this aristocracy isn't exclusive, it isn't narrow, and really larger is better. The more people who meet these criteria, the better. As long as we can meet these criteria without leveling the standards. The goal isn't to have more aristocrats by making it easier to be an aristocrat. It's rather to elevate more people from sort of the common ranks into this aristocracy of intelligence and character. So good leadership from above is the way that you generate a better society and more aristocrats, not by pulling down the leaders you have from below. And then Moore gives these six characteristics, all introduced by the phrase "it will," aristocracy will. He says it will be opposed to any scheme of studies which relaxes discipline or destroys intellectual solidarity. It'll look with suspicion on any system which turns out half-educated men with the same diplomas as the fully educated, which I think is just a condemnation of every university in the country right now. It will distrust the present huge overgrowth of courses in government and sociology, which send men into the world skilled in the machinery of statecraft and with minds sharpened to the immediate demands of special groups, but with no genuine training of the imagination and no understanding of the longer problems of humanity. And I'll talk about how I'm guilty of that when we get to the end. It will think that the dominance of such studies is one of the causes that men leave our colleges with no hold on the past. It will set itself against any regular subjection of the fierce spirit of liberty, which is the breath of distinction and the very character of aristocracy, to the sullen spirit of equality, which proceeds from envy and the baser sort of democracy. And it will regard the character of education and the disposition of the curriculum as a question of supreme importance, for its motto is always, let study become morality, or let your learning turn into action. He gives the Latin there. These, again, he says, are all found in Greek and Latin literature, and they're passed down through the Western canon. In this canon, we see intellect, order, and fate sort of all mysteriously harmonized. That results in the life of freedom. Freedom meaning the freedom to pursue virtue and restrain vice. Freedom that we then codify so that at least people who are not aristocrats can acknowledge it, even if they don't live that way themselves. Did I miss anything with any of that? Anything you'd add to the nature of the aristocracy?
No, I don't think you missed anything. As you were running through that, it made me think about the goal that I think most colleges have. They want to expand access to collegiate education, and I don't. We had a debate resolution a year ago that had us weigh the cost and benefits or the cost of college versus the long-term benefits, and asking the question, is it worth it? And at least the data my team came up with showed pretty conclusively that college education does still strongly correlate with increased salary. So like there's all kinds of goods there. I'm just kind of stuck on whether it's possible. Can you expand college without lowering the standards? And I was thinking of like 1945 and the GI Bill that just overnight tripled the number of students enrolled in colleges in the United States. And there's been all kinds of goods that have come out of that. But I mean, like I feel rather appalled when I go back and look at some of the reading list from like earlier days in the universe. I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm so ill-read compared to these people. But there were like 10 people in their colleges. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I was reading a little bit about Nietzsche as a college professor because he taught the classics, right? He taught Latin and Greek. And he regularly had 3 students in class. Like that was and that was that would have been a big class for him.
Oh my.
Now I think that to the question of can we expand access to college without lowering standards, were I a college administrator, first of all, I would be paid much better than I am now. But also, second, my response to that would be, well, yes, we can, but with the understanding that when we say we're not lowering standards, we're not lowering graduation standards, we're lowering admission standards. And then we will just play catch up once they're in college. We'll get them in the door and we'll give them the remedial classes, and we'll kind of get them up to where they would have been in the past on admission for application. Now, in practice, what that ends up being is A, lots of people just don't bother finishing college because it can be difficult even if you have assistance in catching up. B, you spend longer in college because now you're taking what used to be high school classes in college. And C, in reality, it still pulls down the graduation standards. It's not because of the students; it's because of the changing policies and the pressure from above to not have these people be wasting their time, right? Students should be getting a college education, both for the money they're paying and for the time they're genuinely putting in. Am I really going to fail a student who is genuinely trying and genuinely putting in the effort? And my answer is always, well, yes. But I'm not the only professor here. I'm not the only professor in college. And frankly, there are ways to pass. There are ways to go through and get a college degree without hitting all of what used to be the higher benchmarks, right? Even something like taking Greek and Latin, I mean, I don't even know how long it's been since that's been required. So Moore's core concern is now out the window at most colleges and universities. Anything else to add on this this natural aristocracy stuff?
I don't think so, except to maybe even just note that Moore is definitely on to something. I'm not sure it does still today, over 100 years since he put this essay together, I think, if I remember.
Yeah, 1913, 1914.
Yeah. 100 years later, I mean, there are still elements of this. I mean, there's a reason why for middle class America and up, college is sort of a given expectation. Doesn't mean that everyone goes, but sort of the expectation there. He's right about there being an era. I think he's absolutely right about there being a form that it's an important social marker. And it plays into all kinds of other later in life things that, yep, you are a college educated person.
Right. There's still, I mean, just in kind of a mercenary sense, right, there's, you have more value on the market as an employee with a college degree, often even for jobs that don't require college degrees to do the work. I still wouldn't recommend it to most people, just because I don't think you actually need college most of the time. And I think if you're going to go to college, it's better to do it without debt. Which means it's probably better to go into the trades and get a job that pays well and use that to pay your way through college. But a couple of classes in the evenings on your way through is fine. But again, that's all kind of contrary to where our culture's at now. But we're also not meeting Moore's high standards, right? Not everyone who goes through college comes out fluent in Latin and Greek. I wanted to end this out by talking about problems with this essay, and there are, I think, kind of three that I've thought of, and then you've brought some up too. First, the question is whether or not this is really the purpose of college, right? Is this really what colleges are for? What do you think?
No.
Okay.
I mean, that's my simple one, but my favorite essay that to explain the purpose of college is Michael Oakeshott's Idea of the University. Mm-hmm. He's definitely he's having fun with his title there. He's echoing the famous Idea of the University from John Henry Newman.
Right.
But Oakeshott has a paragraph in there where he talks about the point of the university really being basically, and he's writing in an English context, so you get 3 years. Where you are exposed to the life of the mind, and depending on your aptitude and your willingness, you get to participate in the life of the mind for 3 years. And in those 3 years, you have what he describes as basically total freedom of how you will explore the possibilities that university offers to you. And as soon as that year is done, that time is done, all the practicalities of life slam down. Bills, family, career, all that stuff. But for this brief moment, you really are free to explore areas of interest, areas of aptitude, and you have the most highly skilled and educated people on the planet whose job is literally to help you figure out who you want to become and what you want to be able to do by the end of that season of life. And that season, he argues, never returns. There's never another moment where you have that much freedom over what you can do with your life. And I think that is preeminently the purpose of college. It is tied – I would put college as the point of college is form yourself with this freedom, and it can go really, really badly. That's the downside of freedom. People can destroy their lives by wasting the opportunity that college is. Or you can develop yourself in some really amazing ways that set yourself up for a totally different life. But I don't think that's inherently aristocratic. I also don't see the Greco-Roman classical tradition as being nearly as unified as he does. I don't know if that was another of your problem areas, but I don't understand how people can look back at Greece and Rome and see all of this virtue without Jesus. Like if you pair the Greco-Roman civilization with Christianity, you can get all kinds of amazing virtues. But left to their own devices, the Greeks and the Romans, their virtues are not things we would necessarily celebrate today.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I I'm still thinking through what the point of college is, right? To sort of hit that first one. I mean, on some level, it's pretty clear that the point of college is, you know, beer, women, and sports, or at least the beer, the opposite sex, and sports. I guess I should say in our enlightened 21st century world, that is the objective reality on the ground for a significant portion of the undergraduate population of the United States. I don't think it's necessarily a majority. I wouldn't say it's that's why, you know, 51% of students are in college around the country, but I would say it's probably a large plurality the opposite sex partying and college athletics. And I'm saying this as someone who loves college athletics. I absolutely bleed brown and gold when it's football season. We usually say we'll wait till basketball season gets here, but you know, these years even basketball season isn't great. So that's part of it. Functionally, colleges do job training. I mean, that's kind of the reality on the ground. And if that's the case, well, then we could have this sort of more Paul Elmer Morian spirit and say, well, let's at least try to get this vision of the good in somewhere, and hopefully the little bit we can expose the, you know, future accountants and welders and so on to, that at least they'll have had that. But at that point, it's no longer the purpose of the college, right? It's maybe your purpose as an individual faculty member. And even Christian colleges, so we might read this and say, well, yeah, we agree with this in a Christian perspective, right? Well, we'll say, take out that vision of the good and put in faithful obedience to Christ, and maybe we've sort of hit something. But then again, you look at the practical lives of many Christian colleges, and we're also doing job training. Right. Not all of them, and certainly not as many as the as in the state schools and community colleges, but in general, if you look at what the big majors are at the bulk of the Christian colleges around the country, nursing, right, business, education, maybe if you have a larger school, social work, right? So again, it is trade training. And then we're back to, well, and we also try to encourage them to be better Christians and think about what it means to be a Christian in those trades. But we're kind of stuck in the same position that the state colleges are with respect to this kind of bigger vision. And I'll out myself as being part of the problem. At the end of the day, when I think about what my job is as a professor of political science, it's not my job to give them some kind of grand vision of the, you know, sublime or whatever. It's my job to teach them about Congress. And if they graduate without having, you know, this grand vision of the good, or even at a Christian college, if they graduate without having matured at all as a believer, but they know the unorthodox method by which a bill becomes a law in Congress, I've done my job, right? And if one of my students goes out and robs a bank, I don't know that that's a failure of the institution, right? I mean, I suppose if I'm, you know, encouraging them and buying the gun for them or whatever, maybe it is. But again, this is kind of an ongoing discussion I've been having with others on the network, right? What is our job as professors? I'm sort of in the camp that first and foremost it's to teach whatever our discipline is, and I'm again sort of in the minority on that. So I like what Moore's saying. I agree with him about the aristocrat stuff. I think certainly our aristocrats should have this vision. I don't know that the modern university can do that, or even wants to.
The modern university is lacking the metaphysical foundation that would let it appeal to something it actually says is good.
Right.
I mean, I think the I don't remember who I read writing about this, but it was picking up on the what is a professor's job. I was reading somebody who argued that the going very basic etymology, you're supposed to profess something.
Right.
You're supposed to actually claim something.
Right.
You're supposed to persuade something. And in doing that, that's inherently privileging something as good and dismissing something else as bad, which then prompts the whole Platonic discussion of like, okay, so is there a good? What is the good? But the modern university has already answered that with essentially no. What is good is continued existence with a really big endowment and enough money that we can build whatever will bring us more students.
Right.
And professors seem to somehow be a piece of that equation. So in terms of the pragmatic, like boots on the ground, I think you're probably right about what professors actually are. And again, as an outsider in that discussion, I would argue that hopefully the professor maybe is the one who really embodies what Moore is talking about. I don't know that I, as an undergraduate student, really understood how all the pieces fit together. As a high school teacher, I understand more than my high school students do about how the nature of society goes and why I think some headlines matter and others are just people trying to jack up their ratings. My professors in college were the ones who really had this perspective. They were the ones who embodied that. I remember and there's something about the professor's role of modeling this image of a life that does perceive how everything fits together. So Hillsdale is a ridiculously conservative school.
Right.
But within that conservatism, there's like 18,000 different tribes of conservatives. So I was there in whatever was it 2008 when Barack Obama was elected the first term?
Yep.
Yeah. So I was there 2008 as a sophomore when he was elected, and I and a group of my friends decided that we would demonstrate our sorrow by wearing the darkest clothes we could have. I didn't have any black clothes, so I wore like navy blue. I failed even at wearing morning clothes. This was bad. But we show up in Dr. David Stewart's class. And there's like four of us, and we're like all obviously in mourning that the wrong candidates for our politics won. And Stewart then like looks at us and is like, okay, so you think this is a big enough of a deal that you wore mourning. When's the last time you actually like cried because someone died and his soul went to hell? And like he saw in that moment, at least his job as a professor was to like shake us out of our own little complacent world. And that too is something that like sees the unimportance of what seems hugely significant and tries to fit into a larger narrative. So maybe that's kind of something to take from this essay, if anything, that like this maybe is a great description of the professor.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say that your professor's mistake was noticing or caring what clothes you guys were wearing because, you know, I think there's some truth to that. Maybe in the modern university, maybe even more so the administrator, right? This should be their concern. But then you start getting practical and all right, well, maybe I am supposed to be the one who sort of sees how everything fits together. Is that what I am teaching? Or am I teaching the parts, right? And yeah, again, that's where I'm going to say, well, no, I'm teaching the parts. In the university as a whole, you should get maybe the unified vision, and you should go to my politics class and go to your biology class across campus and go to your religion class and go to your art class and go to your whatever all the different classes are, and across all of those you put all of that together. Is it my job to put them together for you, or even to teach you how to put them together? Again, that's where I'm a little more hesitant. It's my job to teach you about Congress or about Stoicism this semester in my philosophy class, or again, whatever the topic happens to be. And like I said, I know I'm definitely in the minority in the Christian world on that. And it's something I am still kind of thinking through, and it's one of the reasons I'm teaching this class, because I want to think more about it. Maybe a second possible problem is Greek and Latin the core to go with, and you've mentioned this already. Man, if it is, we're all in a lot of trouble, including you and me, right? I've got some. I mean, I've got pretty solid Latin, but my Greek is functionally non-existent, and I love reading the literature, like I love reading it, but I almost exclusively read it in translation. Like I'm just not going to do the hard work, even from Latin, of translating into modern languages. That's such a nightmarish ordeal for me that I rejoiced the last day I had any kind of language class, and then I had kids, and now I'm having to teach my kid a language, and it's, I like my kid. That's what I can say about that. What do you think? Are Greek and Latin the place to go? Is Greek and Latin the place to go? Man, is that plural or singular? That's weird. Stupid languages.
That's a collective. Anyway, there's something about being a collective or singular.
How about this? Should all college students, or at least all aristocrats, have to be fluent in Greek and Latin?
I don't think so. And I'm right there with you on the not having a ton of languages. I've dabbled in several, and I'm proficient in none. So, I mean, there's my own self-interest might be a part of this answer, but I think the Greek and Latin do what Moore wants them to do. They can be a great source of discipline, which in high school and middle school in the classical education world. That's part of why most people require Latin, because it is great discipline and right. It teaches you the basics of how to learn a language. But at the same time, I'm not sold on Moore's answer that the point of college is to learn this disciplined mind. I think the point of college is instead to acquire a habit of curiosity and wonder and learning. Back to put that line from the Timaeus where Plato said that philosophy begins in wonder. College should be a place where you really discover a wonder that propels you to how you want to live the rest of your life. For some people, that might be Latin and Greek. I think the flaw here, and if you know anything about Moore's theological basis, I'd love to know, because I don't know anything about his religion, but I think he is looking for Greek and Latin and the Greco-Roman literature to provide what Christians at least would look to theology and the Bible to provide. That like total answer for like what is it all about and what's it for. He's looking to the tradition. The tradition can do a lot of things, but the tradition is not divine revelation. And I get the sense in this essay that Moore thinks of Greek and Latin as having the effects that Christians would look to divine revelation of having on the human soul.
Right. No, I think that's fair, and I think I agree with that. But then that raises the question of, all right, well, what should be the common core, right? What should be the foundation? And obviously lots of answers have been given, right? The Western canon. Certainly people on the political right would say the writings of the founders, right? The canon is the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers and various other writings from the time. And yeah, again, that's where I stumble a little bit and say, well, gosh, I don't know, right? I certainly have the things I like, and I have my preferences, as far as that goes, I'm going to side with Moore because I tend to like the ancient stuff. I tend to like the Greek and Latin classics, again, in translation. And I think the Western canon is a perfectly good place to go. But I don't know that I'm willing to say that that's something that everyone has to know. I don't know that I'm willing to say that that's the fountain of virtue that everyone has to drink from in order to have kind of a civic virtue that makes you a worthwhile aristocrat.
No, and that makes sense to me. I think that line of reasoning is part of why there is so much diversity in this conversation. I mean, everybody has their list of things they think matter. Hillsdale's answer to that when they were carving out the core in the early 90s was to, or I should say refining the core, because they had a core. Right. They changed it a lot. Was basically to kind of give every major stakeholder in the college curriculum an intro course. So Hillsdale's core is you've got Great Books 1 and 2, which are intro English. You've got Western Heritage and American Heritage. You've got the Constitution class, which really does appeal to our donor base. So there's that added bonus. But then you've got your fine arts credit and your social sciences credit and your science 101 credit and all that stuff. I don't really know. I mean, I don't know. There are some classes I would trade. But I don't have any classes that I would say were unimportant from the core. It's dangerous to get a bunch of academic eggheads around and say, hey, what should we do? Because all of us would say you should do everything, but you should also be a super specialist who knows a lot.
Right.
And somehow you need to do both. And then you start mapping out the credit counts and they're like, well, that doesn't work. We gotta I don't know that that conversation ever really ends. Right. I do think something from Edmund Burke belongs here about being really careful to throw away what people have done for hundreds and in this case thousands of years. Like we should be very careful if we're curating the core or the tradition. Doesn't mean we can't, but we certainly shouldn't. That shouldn't be done rashly.
Right, and in a sense, this would be a much easier question to answer if we were just coming at this as Christians. If we ask the question, you know, what should Christians know? What should Christians read? Yeah, we can answer all of that, right? That's in some ways pretty straightforward. And even with all of the diversity of the tradition, right? We might disagree on, who's more important, John Wesley or Jonathan Edwards, or Augustine or Aquinas, and we can have those arguments, but it's a much more discreet approach, especially once we specialize, right? Once we start saying, well, I want to be a scientist who is a Christian, well, that narrows down my reading options quite a bit, right? Again, if we're going beyond Scripture as that foundation. There. That's a much more discrete set, and it's going to be much easier to come up with a reading list. And same thing if I'm saying, all right, well, great Christian political figures who have been, theologically worthwhile and politically worthwhile. Again, that's an easy discrete list to come up with. Or just generally, right? Who should you be reading as a Christian? Again, we might have disagreements over what specific books, but that's going to be a smaller well to draw from. Once you expand that to say, all right, now I'm trying to educate everyone. This is for society as a whole, not just for Christians. Now that's like, man, that's where it becomes, what do your leaders need? What do your aristocrats need? Well, a little bit of science, a little bit of art, a little bit of literature, a little bit of everything. Yeah. And that's why we end up with the multiversity instead of the university.
Oh, and I'm sure we could do hours more on this, but that brings us around to that's one of the oldest questions in Greek philosophy: is knowledge one or is it many?
Right.
I suspect from our conversation so far, I'm a little bit more towards the knowledge is one, and you're a little bit more towards the knowledge is many side of things. But regardless, if there is such thing as a university, it does have to have some sort of coherent vision that then governs all of that, whether that's a vision of the liberal arts with truth as it's at its center, or whether that's a what kind of Dorothy Sayers maps out in Lost Tools of Learning of like an arch of education with theology as its cornerstone and theology rules over the philosophical disputes and all that. But I think a lot of this discussion about the core ties back to our earlier discussion about purpose. I mean, to go a bit Aristotelian on this question, once we know what the purpose of a college is, we can then figure out in a reasonable way that maybe could bring a lot of people together, hopefully, on board, if we can use reason to discern this based on in alignment with purpose, we can figure out like what's the best way to accomplish that goal. But as long as we're divided on purpose, I don't know that we're going to ever settle on like what's the way to get to that purpose, because we have different endpoints in mind. And by we, I mean like the academy writ large.
Yeah, and even within any given university, right? That's going to be a difference. And again, I don't have a set answer for what I think the purpose of a university is. Even a Christian university. I mean, we have our mission statement, but that only goes so far. So even with the is knowledge one or is knowledge many, I'm actually a knowledge is one kind of guy. I think that as a Christian, right? I mean, we have the book that has the capital T truth in it, but I think that's also not really helpful when you're thinking about a university, which is an institution that is at the end of the day not for Christians. Right, it's something that ultimately is there for society. Right, it's something that's there for the culture and the nation writ large. Slap the name Christian on it if you want to. That doesn't change, unless you're going to say we are a seminary, which now you've shifted things around a little bit, or a Bible college that acts as a feeder into a seminary. Unless you're going to do something like that, as long as you have degrees that are targeted at the world, so again, business, education, nursing, basically every degree at a university, maybe excluding Bible, is going to be targeted on that. That knowledge is one thing, just isn't as helpful, because now you have to train people for the world, for living in society and for living in culture. So, yeah. Again, that's I don't have an answer. I don't know what the purpose of the university is. Ask me in 9 months, and maybe I'll have a better answer for you.
There we go. You can join the long tradition of people who have written books about the purpose of universities.
Oh, I hope not. Those books are terrible.
I've tried to read John Henry Newman so many times. I can't get past it. Like I just can't do it. I've heard the ideas from people I respect deeply, but I just have not been able to get into them.
It's on my list for sometime in the next 6 months. I'm going to sit down and get power through it. Josh, we should probably end it there. I think we're at about an hour. thanks so much for coming on the show, for being willing to talk through this essay with me, and hopefully we'll be able to get you on again at some point in the future. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,